Right, so this is the first in a series of about four podcasts where we'll be talking about different IDEO methods. IDEO, of course, is a design firm that is contracted out by a bunch of bigger companies to design products, whether those be software products, often they're hardware things, often they're just things that, are part of our everyday environment. And so in tutorial, one of the videos that you'll watch is a video of essentially an IDEO team coming up with a really, really good grocery shopping cart. That sounds ridiculous, but I think you'll think it's neat when you see it. So IDEO is a company that basically goes and designs things. And they, as a consequence, they've come up with a number of techniques to understand what people's needs are and understand the kinds of products that people actually want. And if I were to tell you to design a piece of software, one of the things that you would do, probably, as soon as I said, well, do some requirements gathering, is you would go and ask people you know, what problems they're having with the tools that they're having, what they would like, that sort of stuff. And there's nothing wrong with asking, and I think that's a great technique. But today, one of the things I want to do is motivate the need to actually go and observe your users, your potential users, because that gives you a whole different set of insights into their needs. So the way I'm going to do this, I'm going to tell you about the Swiffer product. So Swiffer is a product that you can buy. It's from Procter & Gamble. And essentially what it is it's a mop, or like a really, really thin, light mop that you attach what amounts to a wet paper towel at the very end. And these wet paper towels, of course, are treated in certain ways, and they clean really well. So the story of this, how this product came to be, is really a story that, again, tells us the difference between asking people something and watching what they actually do. So back in the day, Procter & Gamble was trying to figure out what they needed to make a more powerful floor cleaner. And this is a company that, and so at the time, people would mop their floors, right? So they would get these big mops, you know, where it looks like there's a fro at the bottom, kind of. And they can pull out a bucket, and you know, they douse the mop, and then they'd mop the floor, and then they'd put the mop back in the bucket, so on and so forth. So this is the way that people were cleaning their floors at the time. And so Procter & Gamble was trying to figure out how they could build a better cleaning solution. And figuring out this cleaning solution was tricky because, or figuring out the concentration level in this cleaning solution was tricky because the more powerful the cleaning solution, obviously the cleaner the floors would become, but on the other hand, the more powerful the cleaning solution, the more abrasive it was, the more damage it would do to certain kinds of floors, like say hardwood floors. So what Procter & Gamble did was they went to people's houses and they asked them, hey, you know, how do you actually go about cleaning your floors? And everybody would give them the same story. Well, you know, like I pull out my mop, you know, I put in some water in, and I put about this much cleaning solution in. And so, you know, Procter & Gamble was trying to figure out, okay, how much cleaning solution are they putting in? Are they following the instructions? That kind of stuff. But what they discovered was mops are a pain. People don't really, really like it. And in fact, they noticed that people's houses were ridiculously clean by the time they showed up. And so they basically were discovering that, in fact, this method wasn't giving them sort of true insights into what people's behaviors actually were. It was sort of what people were reporting. And so with the next round of interviews, what the Procter & Gamble team did was they would go out, they would go and have a coffee, and rather than tell people, hey, I want to watch how you clean your floors, they would actually deliberately drop their cup of coffee on the floor and make a mess. Right, so you're sitting there. So imagine yourself. You're sitting there. You got somebody from Procter & Gamble here. They're having a coffee, and then they drop their coffee on the floor. This is obviously ridiculous. But anyway, what would happen was they noticed that pretty much everybody would immediately go to the sink. They would grab a big piece of paper towel, and then they would start mopping the floor with the paper towel. And if you think about your own behavior, this is probably what you would do too. And so, what Procter & Gamble realized was that, in fact, this is, you know, this quick and dirty solution to solving the immediate problem was more akin to what people do, that is sort of cleaning up small little problems rather than the big job of mopping up the entire floor. That's something that people do far, far less frequently. And that's what inspired the design of the Swiffer, which is, in effect, a stick that is kind of a really light mop, but at the very end, what you do is you attach a wet paper towel. And so this tells you that, in fact, when you interview people, they are trying to tell you what they think you want to hear often. And in fact, they not only do this by kind of what they say, but they also construct the environment in such a way that they believe that shows well for them. So again, the Procter & Gamble people, they noticed that everybody's houses were clean before they even got there. And this is obviously not a great reflection on... This is a great reflection on the participants, obviously, but this is not a great reflection of what normal households actually look like. All right, so as I said, today what we'll be doing is we'll be talking primarily about the IDEO methods that are under the look category. So I mentioned earlier the IDEO method cards. The IDEO method cards I'm going to post on the website, but you can certainly buy them from William Stout Publishers. It costs you about $50, but what's really great about it is you get a deck of cards that tell you all these different design methods that you can use to kind of inspire design, to refine design, to analyze certain designs, that sort of stuff. Those cards are categorized in suits, sort of, in the same way that playing cards are. There's the look category that we'll be talking about today. There is the ask users for help. So this is asking people about their needs. But asking for help is kind of an interesting way of thinking about what these cards are about. There's the learn, and this is a learn category, which is a bunch of techniques that tell you how to analyze the data that you gather. And then there's a whole bunch of techniques that are about trying, essentially, and trying out the techniques in practice. So today we'll primarily focus again on the look category. The first technique I want to talk about is rapid ethnography. So ethnography is a technique that comes to us from sort of the anthropology space. And this is really about getting yourself involved and embedded in a culture to understand what is happening inside of that culture. And so in anthropology, of course, you have people kind of going and living with these remote, groups of people, nomads, whatever they may be, for years at a time, right, to understand what is happening in that culture. And the purpose, of course, is to sensitize yourself to things that are happening there. And in design, what we do is something we call rapid ethnography, which is similar in the sense that we want to embed ourselves in that culture and understand what's happening, but we want to do it in a much more rapid fashion, obviously. We don't have the time to spend 2 years trying to figure out how to design something. We just want to get in, figure out what's going on, and get back out. So the how in this one is basically spend as much time as you can with the people that you are trying to design for, establish their trust in order to visit and or participate in their natural habitat and witness specific activities. So this gives you a very good first-hand understanding of what is happening in that culture. And by culture, you should understand that I mean this in a very, very broad way. So I don't necessarily mean the difference between, ethnic cultures, for instance. And in fact, a good example of how this was used in early days was they went and they studied how teenagers actually made use of text messaging by, hanging around kids and watching how frequently they texted, where they texted from, so on and so forth. And this kind of technique gives you great insight into how to design stuff for certain things, for certain environments. One of the ways in which I've seen rapid ethnography used is designing technologies for the home. So when we think about technology design, frequently it was motivated by work purposes, so business needs and that sort of stuff. And so a lot of the tools that we have, your Microsoft Word, your PowerPoint, that kind of stuff, these were all driven by business users, essentially, and trying to understand what those people's needs were. But as time has gone on, of course, the price of computation has gone down, and so we begin to see the possibility for these devices to appear in our homes and in our personal lives. And so what we've used rapid ethnography for is to understand what people's needs are in the home and how those, and to try to understand what the culture of the home is and how those needs actually differ from the needs of people that are working in workplaces. And what you see is that families, they rely on routine a lot. There's certain kinds of uncertainties that happen in the home that don't happen in the workplace. So for instance, in the home you have message centers perhaps, and perhaps you have these in your own home, where you put things in certain places. And these certain places become sort of messaging centers. So in my own home, for instance, I will take letters that are for my wife from the mailbox, and I will put them on her placemat at the dinner table because I know that she is going to pass by. I know her routine. I know that she's going to pass by. And I know that at dinner time, certainly, she's going to need to sit down and see these. And this is a way of making sure that she's actually going to see these letters. And so I don't actually need to hand it to her, right? In a business setting, you would do this in a slightly different way, right? Typically, we don't even rely on paper mail. We rely on email because email is much, much faster. And so understanding some of those rituals and understanding those things that happen in the home allow us to design better technologies for the home. A quick example comes from the Nest company. So the Nest company is a company that builds a pretty clever sort of thermostat that you can use in your home. One of the other products that they built was a fire detector, so a smoke detector that you could put on your ceiling, and it was really cool, right? It was connected to your Wi-Fi, so if there was a fire, they could, you know, I guess make a phone call to the local fire station and have firefighters come out and save you and all this sort of stuff. So this is pretty slick. And one of the things that they did was they put a little motion sensor on there so that, you know, when there was a fire or if it was a false alarm, rather than having to grab a ladder and, you know, walk up to, and step up the ladder and then press the button to silence it, you could actually wave your hand and it would silence, right? It would stop because you would know that it was a false alarm. One of the things that they failed to do here was to actually observe what people do when there is a fire. So I've told you kind of all the great things about this product, and if you're like me, you were like, wow, this is great. This makes perfect sense, right? But one of the things that, like I said, they failed to do was to notice what actually happens when people actually have fires in their homes. And in their press release, what they reported was there's a surprising number of people that when there's a fire, they're waving their arms around as they're running out of their house. And so a lot of the early Nest, you know, smoke detector buyers basically had their houses burned down because they were waving their hands. And what that would do is that would signal for the signal to the thermostat to kill itself, right? So obviously that didn't work out so well for those early adopters. But anyway, again, one of the differences between obviously as a designer what you kind of imagine people to do, but probably if you were to ask people, they wouldn't tell you, oh, I wave my hands when there's a fire in the house. But in fact, you need to actually see what's happening. Constructing scenarios where you could actually see a fire take place obviously is very difficult, but in principle you can imagine that this would happen. Sometimes when you go and observe environments, you get to see some of the artifacts that are in the environment space. So here's an image that I grabbed off of Reddit, and what you see here is essentially somebody has taken a remote control and they have put tape over a bunch of buttons that they think grandma doesn't need to actually use. And I suppose, and I don't know, of course, because I don't have you know, any evidence to suggest anything. But I suppose what's happened here is that this probably works very well for grandma. She actually doesn't need all of the buttons that the remotes actually offer. And in a rapid ethnography, what you are looking for is kind of hacks. This is a hack, right? Hacks that people have done to their environment, to artifacts in their environment, that actually help support them to do whatever they want to do. And this tells you basically, hey, for grandma, whoever this home is for, these remotes are ridiculous. They're too crazy. There's too much stuff going on, right? That tells you something about the people that are involved here. Another very common technique is to use a fly-on-the-wall technique. So fly-on-the-wall is a saying where, you know, you say, oh, I would love to have been a fly on the wall during that meeting. And what that means is I would have loved to have been able to observe what people had said or done to or with one another without their knowing that I was there. And what this basically means is observing and recording behavior within its context without interfering with people's activities. So whereas in a rapid ethnography, you were trying to embed yourself in the environment where you are kind of a participant in some sense, where you're perhaps asking questions as part of that process. With Fly on the Wall, you're acting as an independent third-party observer. And why it's a useful technique is because it allows you to see what people actually do within real context and timeframes, rather than accept what they're saying after the fact. So a couple quick examples of this are, you know, imagine people meeting one another inside of a coffee shop, and we were trying to design technologies for them. A very common image that you have in your head is of people sitting and talking with one another and laughing and stuff like this inside of a coffee shop. And this next image is an image that I actually captured inside of a coffee shop. Well, actually, I didn't capture this one. This is one that I downloaded off the web. But this is a very common scene, right? You have people sitting, having coffee with one another, and for some inexplicable reason, they're texting one another. Right? This tells you something different than what they would probably tell you what than what their actual coffee experience actually is. The challenge with this technique, of course, is that just by observing, you may not actually know what people are trying to do, right? So they may actually be trying to do something, but the tools or the environment prevents them from doing what they would really, really like to do. So although capturing what they're doing is a very useful technique, it's not perfect because it doesn't tell you what they would like to be doing. So here's another quick example. It's important to know essentially how people actually make use of the tools that they have today, the existing tools they have, because in designing something else or designing a next revision of it, you don't want to inadvertently break something that they're accustomed to using. So I have no idea how common this is, but again, this is another image I pulled off of Reddit. And what you have here is essentially somebody using a dustpan as a technique to fill their mop pail. And when I see this, it actually makes perfect sense that it could be used this way. And actually, I have no idea how people fill their mops or their you know, mop pails. But this is one way that you could actually do that. So if you were designing the next dustpan, you would probably want to make sure that you kind of had this ability still, because people are using, you know, the dustpan in this way. And if you screw that up, that will make them not like your product very much. Time-lapse video is another technique that you can use. And what time-lapse video does, obviously, is it gives you a sense of how space is used. It gives you a sense of, you know, when people are gathered around certain things, or how people kind of use different areas of an environment in different ways. And I'll just read what it says here. It provides a useful, objective, longitudinal view of activity within a context. And I'll show you a quick video of this in class so that we can talk about it a little bit. Behavioral archaeology is another technique that you can use. And what that essentially amounts to is going into an environment, pulling out and looking at artifacts to see how they're used in terms of where, in terms of placement, in terms of the organization of things. And of course, as I'm saying this, you can see that all of these techniques are sort of related to one another, right? So you can certainly do some behavior archaeology if you're doing a rapid ethnography, right? So if you're in an environment and you're like, oh, I wonder why it is that, you know, these items are placed here. Taking note of those patterns, gives you a cue to pay attention to in the future as you're talking to other people, or as you're watching people and they're interacting with those patterns or piles. The reason why you do this, of course, is that understanding what is happening here reveals how these artifacts are used in people's lives, how they play a role in people's habits. And so one of the easiest examples I have of this here's an image of a desktop of one of my students. You know, it's very easy to say that this is a very messy desktop, right? There are files all over the place, doesn't make any sense. But if you look at it at another layer, at another level, what you see is that there is actually some organization going on here, right? You have applications of a certain type in the top right-hand corner. You have pictures that the person is working on, in the bottom left-hand corner. You have different collections of music, in certain piles all over the desktop. On the bottom right, you have folders that relate to certain aspects of this person's life. And so this is actually, you know, when you see things like this, this tells you something about the organization scheme that computers afford, which is sort of a file folder kind of organization scheme. Whereas, actually, a lot of people rely on sort of piles in their lives, and they don't necessarily think about it in terms of a hierarchy. And in fact, that hierarchical thinking is, it forces people to work in a certain way that may not actually be the way that they would prefer to be working. So in fact, if you were to ask this person, you know, how do you organize your life? How do you organize your files? Or you were to try to understand how they actually do that, you would see that actually this person thinks of things in terms of piles. They think of the things in terms of categories rather than as necessarily a hierarchical ordering. I think this was a really funny comic talking about a microwave and how the 9 button is often neglected. And if you take a look at, so this is a bit of an older image. This is actually an image of my own microwave at home. And you can actually see the wear on the buttons. And for me, I mostly press the plus 30 button, which adds 30 seconds onto the microwave time. But prior to that, I was often microwaving things for, you know, 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 30 seconds, 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 30 seconds. And those are common for me. And you can actually see that reflected in how the zero is kind of, there's some wear there. And the start button, of course, there's a lot of wear there because every time there's an operation, the start button is pressed. I discovered as I lived with my wife, and this is actually something very interesting, when you live with somebody, you actually get to see what your habits are and how they differ from other people's habits. They become very, very much in focus. It turns out that my wife actually does use the nine button a lot. She microwaves things for 99 seconds, which is optimal in some sense to click because that's basically getting a minute and 30 seconds, but you only have to press something twice, which is in fact faster than pressing the plus 30 button because you need to press that 3 times before you hit start. So very interesting example of sort of behavioral anthropology. So some things to pay attention to when you are engaging in these look techniques. You want to figure out what the role of space is, how people are making use of space in terms of their activities. Who are the people that are actually making use of the space? What are the objects that they're making use of in terms of the artifacts? When do certain things happen? What are the triggers that trigger certain things? What kind of workarounds do they come up with? So the dustpan is a really great example of a workaround where it's difficult to get new water perhaps into a mop pail, but you know this gives us the ability to do that. What are their goals? What are their feelings? So some questions you might ask, how is the physical space adapted to the task? So very efficient workers will actually change their environment to suit kind of what they're actually trying to get done. What are the key constraints on the tasks, and where are decisions actually being made? One of the things that you want to go out and do when you're doing these, when you're using these techniques, and you will use one or more of these techniques for your project, is assume that you are wrong. Be very clear about what your assumptions are, and to know that you are thinking about things in a certain way. And go and figure out, and when you're going and making these observations, the point is not to confirm what you think is right. The point is to try to figure out in what ways are you actually wrong? In what ways are people behaving that suggest that the theory that you have in your head is actually incorrect? And I think with that, that's about all we have for this podcast. Thanks for tuning in.